This is lecture number 3. We're on Numbers 13 to 14. Well, the people of Israel have survived a very difficult two-week trek now from Mount Sinai to Kadesh. And you remember that they were at Mount Sinai and they were traveling through the wilderness of Paran, which was very desolate, one of the most difficult areas for them to cross. And now they finally come to Kadesh, which is one of the most fertile oases in the Sinai Peninsula. And they find themselves on the border of the Promised Land. Well, Moses sends out spies to see what the land is like, and they bring back these magnificent bunches of fruit, a vivid proof that what God said is true. The land does indeed flow with milk and honey. But something goes terribly wrong here. The spies' report causes rebellion among all the people, and it results in the postponement of God's promises to inherit the land. Today's lesson, though, is more than just another example of Israel's rebellion. It's really a historical watershed event. It's here in Kadesh that the final break with Egypt is made. God has been unable to redirect their slave mentality, even though He's given them His protection, His provisions, and His promises. So those who long for the luxuries of Egypt are now destined to die in the desert, while their children will be the ones to experience the Promised Land. Well, let's look at chapter 13. And the book of Deuteronomy actually gives us more information into this event. And I'd like you to turn over to Deuteronomy 1:22. It says, "Then all of you came to me and said, 'Let us send men ahead to spy out the land for us and bring back a report about the route we are to take and the towns we're to come to.' And Moses said, 'The idea seemed good to me, so I selected 12 of you, one man from each tribe.'" It was interesting for me to read this because the motivation for this actually came from the people. And Moses listened to them, and it seemed good to him, and he brought it before the Lord, and God apparently allows them to do this, and it would appear from the passage in Numbers that God then directs them as to who should be chosen to go and be the spies. Well, we find 12 leaders are selected, one from each tribe, and the job was described very clearly. They were to observe the land, the cities, the people that are living there, and if they can, to bring back some of the produce. Now, from the Deuteronomy passage, it seems that the purpose of this mission was to strengthen the Israelites' faith. God had given this land, and they were excited about it, and they wanted to see what it was like. It wasn't so that they could have tactic information, military information, because God had already said He would give it to them. We notice when we came to the list of the spies that Joshua is called Hoshea. Now, we know that Moses already renamed him in Exodus 17 after he defeated the Amalekites, but it would appear that Joshua was still being called Hoshea by his tribe and possibly the other people. So now at this point, Moses is ordering everyone to call him Joshua in light of this event. Well, when we were back in Genesis, we studied a little bit about name changes. And we learned that someone with a unique relationship to that person would have the ability or the authority to change its name. For example, a parent can give a name to a child, and we know that they weren't given names until they were at least 8 days old so that they could determine their personality or what God wanted them to be named. We also saw that God changed names in the Old Testament. Abram was changed to Abraham. Abram meant exalted father, while Abraham meant the father of multitudes. The same with Sarai, Sarai to Sarah, which meant mother of multitudes. Jacob was given the name supplanter. That's what Jacob means, because he grabbed at his brother's heels when they were coming out, and of course he stole his brother's birthright. And God changed his name to Israel, which means one who fights victoriously with God, or one who struggles with God. And we saw that when he struggled with God or the angel of God, whichever it was, that he was victorious. And that's basically what Israel does. It's very prophetic. They struggle with God. In this case, Hoshea, which means God is salvation, was a prayer for salvation, while Joshua means the Lord saves, and it's actually a promise. So Moses says, every time you say Joshua, you are saying God saves, the Lord saves. And it's reminding them of the promise that it is God who will save them. It's interesting because in the New Testament, the Greek translation of Joshua is Jesus. Well, the spies begin in the southern part, which is called the Negev, and work northward towards the mountains, which is called the hill country. The Negev is a dry area, and it's unsuitable for agriculture, and it runs from the southern border all the way up to Beersheba. The hill country then picks up with Beersheba, and it runs all the way north of the Sea of Galilee, and that's a mountainous or hilly area. Well, while they're traveling, the spies are told to bring back some fruit. And then in parentheses, it tells us that it's the beginning of the season for grapes. Now, this would place it about late July or early August, which would mean it has been approximately 2 months since they've left Sinai. And we find the spies carrying out Moses' directions exactly as they were given. They cross the land of Canaan from the south to the north, and it's a distance of about 250 miles each way. And it would take about 40 days to travel that kind of a distance on foot. Well, when they travel through the hill country, they mention Hebron. And Hebron is a very large city, but if you remember back to Genesis, that was the place that God first gave the promise of Abraham that he would inherit this land. They also said that some of the inhabitants of Hebron were descended from Anak. How did they know that? Because of their names, as well as their size. Now, the city was large and well fortified. And then they also mentioned the Valley of Eshul, which means the cluster. Now, this would have been near Hebron, and they would have come through here probably on their way back, and they found pomegranates, figs, and grapes. They said it was carried on a pole by two men. Now, because the spies are saying how big everything is, you know, the Anakites are there and everything like that, we automatically assume that, oh, these grapes were so huge that it took two men to carry a bunch. That's not true. If you and I were to carry some grapes from here to San Diego on foot, if we hugged them or carried them, chances are they would be bruised. So the easiest and the best way to carry them as well as protect them would be to string branches across poles of the figs and the pomegranates and the grapes. So they were carried between two men on a pole simply to protect the grapes, although they were good-sized bunches because that area is known to produce between 10 and 12 pound bunches of grapes. So whereas they were large, it was not because of their size that they carried them, but simply to protect them. Well, when they arrive back at camp, Moses asks for a report, and the first report begins with a rather cool and objective description of what Moses had asked them to observe. Look at verse 27. "We went into the land to which you sent us, and it does flow with milk and honey. Here is its fruit." Now, the term "flowing with milk and honey" comes up a lot in the Bible, and so I looked into that. Flowing with milk really refers to the fact that it's a good place for herds and flocks. It's not agriculture, but it's a place where they can raise their animals and they produce milk, both for their young and for the people. Honey was actually a syrup that they got from dates, and dates grow in palm trees in arid areas. It was not honey from bees, as you and I would think. So flowing with milk and honey means it's a good pasture area, and there are a lot of dates also there. But even with this factual report, we see a hint of their attitude in the very first words. Look at it. They call Canaan the land to which you sent us. I want you to think about this. Today's lesson pointed out at least 8 or 10 references to the land, and it was always referred up to this point as a land which the Lord swore to give them, or the promised land, or something like that. It was always attached to the promise. The spies are avoiding that altogether. Look at verse 28. "But the people who live there are powerful, and the cities are fortified and very large. We even saw descendants of Anak there. The Amalekites live in the Negev, the Hittites, Jebusites, and Amorites live in the hill country, and the Canaanites live near the sea and along the Jordan." The spies were drawing attention away from the fertility and the goodness of the land which God had told them it was there, and focuses on the obstacles to what they feel are in the way of their conquest. The people are strong, the cities are fortified and very large, but we saw Anak there. As Pastor Dave said in his sermon on Sunday, the Anakites were very large people. Anak is the Hebrew word, and it means long neck. And it's said that the Anakites were between 7 and 9 feet tall. There were some that were even larger than that. But the average person would be between 7 and 9 feet, and they were great, fierce warriors. And we have actual papyruses from the 13th century BC that talks about the fierce warriors of Canaan that were 7 to 9 feet tall, as well as archaeologists have found skeletons of females that were above 7 feet tall. Well, they also mention the other people that are inhabiting the land, and God had already told them those people were there. The Amalekites were descended from Abraham through Esau, and they're nomads that are living in the Negev. The Hittites, Amorites, and Jebusites are living in the hill country. And the Hittites are probably Syrian. They come from Noah's son Shem. While the Amorites, little is known about them, and their name simply means Westerners. The Jebusites are more interesting. They come from Noah's son Ham, and they are actually living in Jerusalem. And then they go on to say the Canaanite, which is a general term, are the people that are living around the coast, whether it's on the Mediterranean or on the Jordan River. Well, these first-hand details about the residents give the spies authority. And this helps convince the people of the impossibility of the conquest. Up to this point, the phrase, a land flowing with milk and honey, has always been tied to God's promises and the fact that they will inhabit the land. Now, the spies are questioning that conclusion. They look at these nations as insurmountable obstacles. They are not a confirmation of God's promises. And the people believe the spies, and so they start murmuring and complaining amongst themselves because they are afraid. Well, at this point, Caleb steps forward, and Caleb's name is great. It means all heart. Look at verse 30. Then Caleb silenced the people before Moses and said, "We should go up and take possession of the land, for we certainly can do it." Caleb's attempt to calm the people and rekindle their faith in the promises is immediately scoffed by the other spies. This time, they've got the crowd riled up, and they start exaggerating and embellishing on the first report, and it becomes even more outrageous. In the second report, the people aren't just strong, they're much stronger than Israel. The people aren't just of great size, they make Israel look like grasshoppers. And the land, though it's good, it devours anyone that lives in it. And the final straw, it's not just Anakin, the Nephilims are there. Well, God calls this an evil report. And it does not mean simply that they describe the land as evil, but their accusations are untrue, and it's a false report. The claim that the land eats its inhabitants means that if they go up there, they're going to be destroyed. They not only refer to the tall man as Anak, but as Nephilim. And you remember back to Genesis that Nephilim means the fallen ones, and it refers to the angels that fell with Satan. They came to earth, they cohabitated with women, and created a super race. They created what is called the superheroes of old, and they were very large and very powerful, and that was one of the reasons why God wiped out the earth with the flood. Then the spies said they feel like grasshoppers, or they seemed like grasshoppers. That's like you and I saying, well, we were just shrimps compared to everyone else. Well, in chapter 14, the rebellion reaches its climax. The report of the spies causes the people to lose heart, and they grumble against Moses and Aaron, and they even blame God. They think that anything they've experienced up to now in the desert will be better than going into the promised land. Time has apparently already dulled their memories of Egypt. When they were in Egypt, they were crying bitterly for God to save them. Now they're looking back in wistfulness and wanting to return. This is the second national rebellion. The earlier rebellion was with the golden calf. They looked back on Egypt, and it was a wistful heart, but they continued on to follow God. This time, they actually proposed to return, and this becomes the final rebellion. They have completely rejected God's plan of redemption and going into the promised land. Think about it. From the time God took them out of slavery to this point, there's been one mission. And that is to bring Israel into the promised land. Now, with the goal in sight, they suggest giving it all up. Not only are they rejecting the goal, but by proposing to elect a new leader, they are rejecting Moses, who is their divinely appointed mediator of salvation. Look at verse 4. And they said to each other, we should choose a leader and go back to Egypt. No wonder Moses and Aaron fell on their faces. It was not to plead for their lives, but to express awe at the blasphemy of the people. And we studied blasphemy before. You do not do that. Falling on one's face is an ultimate expression of worship and awe. They knew God's presence were there. They fell to the ground in fear of what he was about to do. God had come out and with his fire devoured Aaron's sons for just bringing unauthorized fire. Now these people are rebelling against him. But God does not judge them immediately. The people are given one last chance to repent. We find Caleb and Joshua pleading with them to trust God, and as a visual picture of what they're doing, they tear their clothing. This is what the Israelites do and the Jews do today. They rip their clothing as an expression of extreme grief. The people have just stated that their children would be taken captive if they go into Canaan, and now they're about to select a new leader who will take them back to Egypt. Now, Joshua's appointment as Moses' successor seemed to be pretty sure, but we haven't seen it much since the book of Exodus. Now we find Joshua stepping forward. There's a rebellion just about ready to take place here, and by stepping forward and defending the Lord, he almost assures them that they will have a future, and he will be the leader to take them in. It's interesting because Joshua and Caleb's report is really very similar to what the other spies say. They don't dispute the account of the inhabitants, but what they do is, don't be afraid. They may look like Superman, but we have the Lord. We have nothing to fear. What does the congregation do with this information? Look at verse 10. They say to stone them. Now, this is not simply a mob lynching. If you think about stoning, what was that? We learned in Leviticus that that was a punishment for a crime. They're accusing Joshua and Caleb of rebelling against the Lord and bringing false witnesses, and yet they're bringing the two witnesses. At this critical moment, the Lord appears. Continue on with verse 10. So while the whole assembly talked about stoning them, the glory of the Lord appeared at the tent of meeting to all of the Israelites. I want you to picture this in your mind. I want you to think about this. Here you are at the tabernacle, the tent of the meeting. Moses and Aaron and the priests are probably just outside the door to the tent of meeting, and the spies are maybe in front of them, facing the crowd, and around in the tabernacle area would be all the clan leaders and the tribal leaders, all the representatives, and then the people would probably be outside of the curtains to the tabernacle because there would be too many of them. And here we have the spies giving their account, riling up all the people, and you hear all this commotion with the people as they're talking about rebelling against God, and then you find Joshua and Caleb stepping forward and doing this, and the people saying, now we're going to kill them. And all of a sudden, the glory of the Lord, the Shekinah glory of the Lord, comes down right in the midst of them. And I think Moses and Aaron were on the tent side. The glory of the Lord was in the middle, and the spies and the people were on the other side. And we know he was in the form of a cloud, but the Shekinah is bright, brilliant. So I don't know whether there was lightning flashing all around in this cloud or whether it was just the whole cloud was so brilliant. But God has a plan, and these people are not going to stop his plan. He will not be sidetracked. And God is angry, and he says to Moses in verse 11, how long will these people treat me with contempt? How long will they refuse to believe in me? In spite of all the miraculous signs I have performed among them, I will strike them down with a plague and destroy them. But I will make you into a nation greater and stronger than they. What is God doing? This is why I think he's in between them. He's speaking to Moses, and I don't think anybody else is hearing what he's having to say, but he says, I'm going to wipe these out. I'm going to send my fire out here and wipe out the entire nation. I'm going to start over with you, Moses. Now, this is the second time God has suggested this to Moses. It happened again back at that golden calf incident when God says, I am going to wipe them out, and I'm going to start over with you, Moses. And at that time, Moses had said to the Lord, pleaded with him, you can't do that, Lord, because here you brought us out, and we told the Egyptians that our God was going to take us into Canaan, and if you kill us all here, they'll say that you weren't able to do that. Once again, Moses used that same plea. He says, God, he says, all the people around us know that you are taking us into Canaan and that's the land you promised to us. If you wipe us all out, they'll think that you can't do it. He says, God, I know you and you are steadfast and true to your promises. Therefore, I would like you to spare them. Well, as usual, Moses' plea is heard in verse 20. The Lord replies, I have forgiven them as you have asked. Nevertheless, as surely as I live and as surely as the glory of the Lord fills the whole earth, not one of the men who saw my glory and the miraculous signs I performed in Egypt and in the desert, but who disobeyed me and tested me 10 times, not one of them will ever see the land I promised on oath to their forefathers. No one who has treated me with contempt will ever see it. God promises that he will forgive them, but the rebels will not enter the promised land. He says they have tested him 10 times. In Hebrew, that's like our English saying, they have tested me over and over again. Now, though he is willing to forgive, this does not always undo the consequences of his people's sins. God's purposes will be carried out in spite of their sin. Look at verse 25. Turn back tomorrow and set out toward the desert along the route to the Red Sea. This suggests that they are returning to Egypt. But typical of the irony of this story, their punishment is made to fit the crime. They wanted to die in the wilderness and return to Egypt. They said, if only we had died in Egypt or in the desert. That was in verse 2. Well, God warns them 4 times in 6 verses that their bodies will fall in the wilderness. And they said that their children would perish if they went into Canaan. Now it will be only these children that will be permitted to enter. In a way rather different from what they intended, God grants them their request. Entering the promised land will be postponed to let the generation of rebels die in the desert where they want it. In verse 29, we read who this generation is that's to die. It says, every one of you 20 years old or more who was counted in the census and who grumbled against me. God has just said that Joshua and Caleb would live because they had not rebelled, but it's interesting to note that it was only those who were counted in the census and who rebelled. Who was not counted? Any of the leadership, the priests, or the Levites. We know several of them make it in, so it would appear that they were not involved in the rebellion, and if they were, it would have been on an individual basis, not as a tribe as a whole. Well, the 10 spies with the evil report had been false witnesses. They accused the land of murder, if you will, of homicide. And by doing so under the Levitical law, the punishment for bearing false witness was death. Look at verse 37. These men responsible for spreading the bad report about the land were struck dead and died of a plague before the Lord. The plague before the Lord always is an act of God, as we say, God struck them dead. When we see lightning or tornadoes or whatever, we declare it acts of God. It's the same type of thing. God struck them dead. God's verdict is now final. Moses pleads to forgive their sins and spare the lives has been granted. However, the people that accepted the false testimony or witness of the spies and not the true one given by Caleb and Joshua would suffer a similar death. The fate they feared that they would meet by going into Canaan would now actually happen in the desert. Look at verse 39. When Moses reported this to all the Israelites, they mourned bitterly. Mourning was indeed appropriate, given Moses' message that though they would not die immediately, they would face certain death in the wilderness. The amazing part to me is that the people still did not believe Moses. They think now all we have to do is acknowledge the mistake, that'll be enough, and then we'll set out on our own and take the promised land. They didn't believe God would give them the promised land, but now they're willing to go in their own strength to possess the land. Moses warns them. Look at verse 44. He says, don't go up because I'm not going, the ark's not going. But nevertheless, in their presumption, they went up towards the high hill country. though neither Moses nor the Ark of the Lord's Covenant moved from the camp. What was the result? A resounding defeat at Hormuth on the southern border of Canaan. These concluding verses underline really the message of the whole spy story. Israel still does not take God seriously or listen to Moses, his appointed representative. No one will enter Canaan until they learn their lesson, and it's going to take a very long time. When I was studying this lesson, two attitudes really startled me. I saw contempt and presumption. I looked them up in the dictionary. Contempt means the feeling or action of a person towards someone or something he considers low or worthless. These people knew God, and yet they felt his promise was worthless. That was really scary to me. These people had God's very presence with them, yet they considered it worthless. God gave them several opportunities to repent. He could have wiped them out right there, but he continued to extend his grace. However, they did not receive his promises. Why? Because in their heart, they considered it worthless. Well, most of us have people in our lives who know of God and his word and yet treat it with contempt. I would encourage each of you to be a Moses in their life, a person that would mediate or pray for them. Moses had a great role to play in the nation of Israel, but ultimately it's the individual's choice. But Moses never gave up on him, did they? He continued to pray and intercede on their behalf. The second word was presumption, and that means an overstepping of proper bounds, a forwardness, or taking someone or something for granted. Israel refused to believe God and chose to disobey rather than to trust and obey. When the consequences of their action was not to their liking, they overstepped their bounds and tried to do it on their own, which resulted in further disobedience. This should be a real wake-up call to all of us. The Bible is very clear on what we are to do and what God requires of us, and we cannot presume to do otherwise. There are a lot of areas in our lives, though, where it's not clear-cut in the Bible, like where should I live and whether I should work or not. But God says that we're to bring those concerns before him in prayer. He says, "Ask me and I will answer you." And you and I need to be sure that when we're making those decisions in our lives, that we have God's direction, that we take it, that we ask him, and that we wait for his answer. Now, sometimes his answers aren't real clear, but in that case, after diligently praying and feeling comfortable with the direction, what I do is say, "Okay, God, I think this is what you want me to do, and I'm going to go on it assuming it's your will. But if it's not, and I haven't heard from you real clearly, then stop me." But this word presumption, going forward in our own effort, is a real warning to us. We need to really think about it. Our God is an awesome God. His will, his plan will be accomplished with or without the help of man. But he has many promises and many blessings for us if we are willing to believe in him, have faith in him, and trust and obey him.